Welcome to today's Reason podcast. I'm Catherine Mangu-Ward, editor-in-chief of Reason magazine, and I am joined by Eugene Volokh. He is a law professor at UCLA and the founder of The Volokh Conspiracy, which is one of the most widely read legal blogs in the United States, according to some advertising copy that they put on their own page. So it's probably all lies. Thank you for chatting with me, Eugene.
Always a great pleasure, especially to see talk to someone who sees through things as well as you do.
Obviously, the Volokh Conspiracy is now hosted at Reason, which has been a delight, both for me as an editor and I hope for our readers and yours. One thing that I wanted to talk with you about today is our new issue, which is the July issue of the print magazine. We're calling it the Burn After Reading issue, and it contains a bunch of how-tos of activities that we are describing as on the borders of legality. So this is stuff like how to build a Glock using tools you have at home, how to make pot brownies, how to hire an escort, how to conceal your online identity, and more. You are a little bit of an expert in crime facilitating speech, which is the title of a paper you wrote some 13 years ago. So I want to talk about almost but not quite talking about breaking the law. What do you say?
Well, it's a great question. The Supreme Court has dealt with for basically a century the question of when is speech constitutionally protected, even when it advocates crime. So those are the World War I cases, all the way up to Brandenburg v. Ohio in 1969. And since then, courts have talked a good deal about that. And generally speaking, there's pretty broad protection even for speech that advocates crime. But curiously, there's been virtually nothing decided by the court on the question about speech that facilitates crime, that conveys information that helps people commit crimes. Possibly quite unintentionally, when they go into bomb makers' headquarters, they arrest them, and they look at their shelves, and sometimes they see chemistry textbooks. Sometimes they might see manuals on the use of explosives. Of course, they're perfectly lawful uses of explosives for road building and various other kinds of things. Unsurprisingly, the bomb makers, not being idiots, look to serious works like that. Plus, also, there are other kinds of books like the Anarchist's Cookbook, which at least the assumption is that that is actually intended to promote crime. So how does the law deal with that? How should the law deal with that? Turns out we actually don't know. Generally speaking, prosecutors don't try to go after people who publish this kind of material. So there haven't been a lot of cases. But it's surprising that there is no crime facilitating speech doctrine. The label is just my label. I invented it for my article, the way there is a doctrine for incitement or fighting words or libel or obscenity and the like. And this issue, the obvious thing is something like making bombs. But this issue comes up in lots of other situations too. Say, newspapers reporting on some crime and they reveal the name of a witness. That may facilitate retaliation against the witness, somebody who wants to silence the witness, maybe kill the witness or intimidate the witness so the witness doesn't testify. They may learn the name of the witness from this newspaper article, quite not intended by the newspaper, but perhaps the newspaper might have been aware that there's this risk. How should the law deal with that? Not at all clear. There are a few cases on the subject going in different directions. It seems pretty likely, given some recent Supreme Court precedent, that that's constitutionally protected speech. But it's surprising sometimes how much is unsettled in the law, even as to issues that you'd think would be have been resolved a long time ago.
So I actually want to talk about that a little bit, because I think this is something that, as a layman, seems surprising to me. I mean, this idea that the answer to is this legal about any particular behavior might genuinely be, I don't know, I guess you could try it and find out. I think that's something that people have this imagination of the law as black and white and clear. And even when laws do need to be interpreted, which of course they do, that it seems that there should be some sort of ruling precedent or some kind of clarity. And this seems like a big deal, right? This seems like something that people do pretty often. They walk up to these lines of talking about behavior that might be illegal or as you use the term, facilitating it in some way. Is this true everywhere and always in all kinds of areas of the law? Or is there something special about this this cluster that has made clarity elusive, do you think?
It's true in a lot of areas of the law, though not all. Generally speaking, this is our so-called common law system, where the law, at least originally, much of criminal law, still a lot of tort law, property law, contract law, was made by judges in specific cases. There wasn't a code. There wasn't a statute that said, here is what is illegal. It was just developed by judges, in part because of what seemed right in a particular case, in part based on the norms of the community. So at some point in the mid-1800s, there came this codification movement in the U.S. Of course, European law had long been much more codified. And the theory was, no, we need to make things clear for people. We're going to come up with statutes, and statutes will define things. And it turned out that life is complicated, and it's hard to boil down in a simple statute. So sometimes you have statutes that do things like prohibiting aiding and abetting. Well, all right, it's illegal to aid and abet crime, but what counts as aiding and abetting crime? That's something that turns out the statute doesn't define, or if it does define, this often leaves other questions that are not resolved, and that leaves it for courts to define. And now, in some areas that are frequently litigated, there's a lot of case law, and in many such situations, that case law provides a good deal of guidance. But if you have a situation where prosecutors rarely prosecute, and this is an area where probably quite rightly they do rarely prosecute, you actually don't get a lot of such precedents. So you'd think the statutes would be clear, but it turns out it's much harder to write a clear statute to deal with a complicated set of factual circumstances than you'd think. You'd think the precedents would be clear, but sometimes there aren't a lot of precedents because there aren't a lot of prosecutions. Now, you look at some areas of the law. Tax law, usually, not always, but usually it's pretty clear what it mandates in particular situations. But tax code is sort of proverbial for this complicated, long, detailed thing that's very hard to understand. So maybe we could have theoretically clear results if we tried to come up with this comprehensive code, but it wouldn't be particularly clear to users of the law, to people who are subject to the law, because then we just be so complicated that it's hard to get through all that. It's a difficult question. And by the way, American legal scholars have been dealing with it for two centuries at least, and European scholars have debated it for a long time, even before that. So it's you'd think the law would be clear in these kinds of situations, but in many areas it isn't, and maybe it can't be.
I wonder if we could talk a little bit about some specific things in this issue, because as an editor, I found myself, you know, trying to think about these things with a lawyer's mind. And in particular, you know, one of the pieces in this issue is how to hire an escort. And it's written by a woman who is a sex worker, Maggie McNeil. And she filed the piece a couple months back before the passage of the FOSTA-SESTA legislation. So this is the, God, what does that acronym stand for? Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act, I guess is what FOSTA is. And that law explicitly criminalizes under federal law hosting digital content that promotes or facilitates prostitution and explicitly holds web publishers and platforms liable, which is a big change from at least what federal law said before. And so we found ourselves with an article that had been drafted under a sort of totally different legal, you know, in a totally different legal landscape, now publishing it in a moment when there was not a lot of clarity about how that new law would be applied and whether the type of thing we were proposing to publish, which was basically a how-to, would fall afoul of it, right? Because we weren't exactly, you know, you couldn't click through on anything in the article and hire an actual sex worker. On the other hand, you could easily go from being a person who had no idea how to hire a sex worker to someone who could have a pretty good idea of what to do going forward. And I found myself sort of thinking, well, this is, you know, this is a somewhat theoretical question, and it's a question about my speech rights for me as an editor, but for all of the you know, primarily women who were being described in this piece, it's a question of their livelihood as well, and the lack of clarity about what this law will look like when it starts to get implemented was so striking to me. And I wonder, you know, when someone comes to you as a client or for advice and they say, well, what do you think is going to happen under a law like this? What's your process for trying to answer that question?
It's hard. Well, first I tell them that's why we get paid the big bucks. Or sometimes the medium-sized bucks.
I was going to say, those sex worker rights nonprofits always shell it out the big bucks, probably, to get questions like this answered. But yes.
But that is indeed a serious problem. You know, maybe if you're Google or you're IBM or you're General Motors, you can afford all these lawyers and you can afford to deal with uncertainty better. In civil cases, you can insure well against the uncertainty. Obviously, harder to do with regard to criminal law. But what about ordinary people? What about small nonprofits? How do you make things? How do you make the law clearer for them without having to hire a high-priced lawyer and have the lawyer investigate things very closely? It's a very serious problem. I don't want to minimize it. It's just it turns out that it's really hard to make sure that the law is clear in all circumstances. I do think that the text of the law often provides a good deal of black and white, even if a considerable amount of gray. I think sometimes we forget how much is clear. Let me just give you an example. Let's say I sue you for libel. Not that I ever would. Not that you'd ever libel. But in any event, there are all sorts of questions about both the facts, even if the legal standard is clear. Sometimes it's the facts that are unclear, and about legal rules. But it's one thing is pretty clear is at the end of this civil lawsuit, you're not going to go to prison because it's a civil case. And we take for granted that actually that's a pretty clear rule, that unless you've, say, violated an injunction or something like that, civil case, certain remedies are available, other remedies are not. And you'd say, well, yeah, obviously you won't. Well, yes, it's true. The law does actually make this obvious. And we just dismiss that value of the law because we take it for granted, because there are so many things that are clear about the law. On the other hand, imagine a law that seems the clearest possible, a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit on some road. And let's set aside the fact that some speed limits actually provide for an inquiry into reasonableness of how fast someone is going. Let's assume it's a sharp, clear 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. Sounds perfectly clear, right? So let's say you're pulled over by a police officer. And the police officer says, I'm going to give you a ticket for driving 65 in a 55. You say, okay, fine, you know, all right, that I did that. He says, here's another ticket and another and another. Here are 10 tickets. And let's say each of the tickets for $100, you owe me $1,000. Or you owe not me, but the government $1,000. So why? He says, well, you know, you weren't just speeding once, right? You were speeding for 10 seconds. And then you were speeding for 10 more seconds. And then I saw you slow down to under 55 and you sped up again. So you're speeding some more. And you're lucky I didn't give you 100 tickets for every second you were speeding. Now, that's something that it's pretty clear what the custom is. It's pretty clear what common usage is. But there's nothing in the statute that indicates essentially what the denominator is for how long you need to be speeding in order to get a ticket. Occasionally, you do see something like that, that for certain offenses, every day is a separate violation, but not every minute. But for traffic offenses, that isn't clear. Again, you'd think that would be clear, and probably in practice, in the way it's actually enforced, it's quite clear. But even for something that looks like about as clear a rule as you could imagine, there are uncertainties such as this. So in any event, so just to answer your question, and I realize I've been talking around it in various ways, you look at the text, you also look at the reality of how prosecutors and others have been behaving to date. The problem is sometimes attitudes change, and all of a sudden something that was long tolerated now becomes legally, not just legally punishable, but becomes actually prosecuted. But in fact, a lot of what you're paying for with a lawyer isn't just somebody who could read the law, but somebody who understands what the practices are of enforcement of the law. So I wish I could give you a better answer. I wish I could give you an answer that was more that was less mushy, that was more clear. But
every lawyer ever about everything.
Right.
I think that's
right. I don't make the law. I just report on it.
Yeah.
But Catherine, let me ask you.
Yes.
So you said you were looking at these articles as a lawyer or with a lawyer's eye. That's great. And, you know, people have to do that for a lot of things that they do. But I want to know how you think about this with an editor's eye. Are there things that you'd have submitted to you that you'd say, you know, I don't think it's right for us to inform people in such detail about how they could commit a crime? To be sure, we wouldn't be intentionally promoting crimes. We wouldn't be actually committing crimes. Maybe we'd even have the legal right to disclose this information, whether it's general information or specific information, such as people's names or addresses or what have you. But I just don't think it's right for us to do that. How do you think through that?
So we actually talked about that a lot with respect to this issue, though we talk about it a surprising amount more generally. One place where this comes up quite regularly, actually, is just to stay on the same theme, although a different author, is in the work of Elizabeth Nolan Brown. She covers the sort of politics and policing practices that are associated with sex work. And one thing that we have a very firm policy on is that many states and many localities, they publish mugshots of people who have been arrested, both johns and prostitutes. And they often publish these before there's been any adjudication, right? They're taken upon arrest. And as a result, these photographs are often out there. And when we're writing about someone's case, if it's pending, we make it a point to not publish the mugshots of people who are accused of victimless crimes. And where we don't have permission from these people or where it hasn't been widely published elsewhere, we also try not to use their names. So that's an example of not quite crime facilitating speech, but a place where we would be well within our legal rights to use both those images and those words, but we choose not to because of kind of a moral position and a position about the morality of the underlying law. You know, this is surprisingly tricky to keep a hold of, and it's surprisingly rare in our industry. People are very quick to grab mugshots in particular and run them all over the place. So that's one way, I think, in which we sometimes interact with this. For this issue in particular, you know, some obvious reference points here are the Anarchist Cookbook, which, you know, we sort of jokingly said, okay, this issue is similar to that, except, you know, to us, there was a very big difference between publishing instructions about how to build a handgun and just publishing instructions about how to build a bomb. And for us, the distinction was, well, what point were we making? What was the context in which we were publishing these instructions? And the point that we were making in the case of the gun was about the difficulties of prohibition, about how, you know, the gun control proposals that are constantly being floated would be completely subverted by the widespread use of this very simple set of online ordering and, you know, alteration using household tools. So for us, it was, first of all, what do we want to say? And then second, how can we offer kind of how-tos that illustrate that point? And there's nothing to be illustrated by, here's how to make a Molotov cocktail, from our perspective, whereas there's a lot that's demonstrated when we show users what it means to build a gun.
So, you know, I think that that's a great analysis. And my guess is I probably have almost the same bottom line reactions as you when I make decisions about what to publish myself. Let me ask about a few cases where I don't know what the right answer is, but I think they're a little harder. So let's say there's a particular case you're writing about, and let's say there's a police officer involved. And let's start with a situation where the police officer is actually not accused of any really serious wrongdoing. Maybe he's enforcing a law we agree is a good law. Maybe he's enforcing a law that we might think is a bad law, but as best we can tell, he's doing it in good faith. He's just doing his job and he's not violating the Constitution in the course of doing that. And let's say there's a photograph. Maybe the person being arrested took the photograph or some such. And you're thinking about posting it, but the police department gets in touch with you and says, look, we're not threatening you. If you have the legal right to post this photograph, but we will just tell you this police officer works undercover. And if you post this photograph, this is going to jeopardize his life because people will then know he's a police officer. And maybe that'll be in the context of drug investigations or something that you think are wrong, but he's just doing his job. And presumably, we agree he shouldn't get killed for that. Although maybe you might say, no, if we publish the photograph, it won't actually jeopardize his life because you'll know to pull him out of the field. Well, okay, they say they'll jeopardize his career. How do you make these kinds of decisions? Again, imagine somebody actually gives you this photograph, and it's actually the photograph is of a scene that you think really does illustrate what's going on. And then you have to make a decision whether to use the photograph or maybe actually just to, whether to blur out his face or not. How would you make that decision?
So I think there's one thing to note here. I always want to engage hypotheticals on their own terms, but I think, you know, publications have a long history of dealing with claims like that one from not only law enforcement, but in particular from the military, from you know, Department of Defense, where they say, if you publish this information, you are endangering the lives of American soldiers or American law enforcement officers. And that claim is made so often to journalists. It's a very, very common move on the part of agents of the state who don't want bad publicity. So I think the first step in evaluating something like that is to evaluate whether that claim has been made in good faith, because it so, so often isn't. And in fact, we published a piece about a month ago where we sent an intern to attempt to liberate some body cam footage from the state of Virginia that was about, that was showing a traffic stop that went badly. In this case, the footage had been shown to some journalists, but then the state had refused to release it for general consumption. And they claimed that it was because it was part of the officer's personnel file. And those that information is protected from FOIAs. So that's it's not a claim of safety, but it's a similar thing where they're saying, you know, this is something that's off limits to what would generally be considered the type of information you could access in the public interest as a journalist or even just as a citizen. And that's a sort of softer version of that same disingenuous move where you say, oh, the consequences of giving you the press this information will be so dire for this individual or for the cause in some way that we couldn't possibly do it. So we will assume that I believe all of the players here are in fact acting in good faith and what they claim is true. You know,
let's say that actually it does sound really plausible. I mean, they say, you know, this is a photo of some arrest or something in some gang enforcement context, and we'll just tell you. And we'll show you some documents that show that this particular police officer is undercover in the gang. I mean, there's just you can be skeptical about many things, but there's real evidence that he is. And, you know, if he isn't undercover in the gang, it shouldn't be terribly controversial that publishing his photograph is gonna cause real trouble. At the very least, it'll jeopardize our investigation of the gang, because probably what will happen is we'll have to pull him out so he doesn't get killed. So let's assume that you know, you listen to them and they have a good track record. They haven't lied to you in the past. It sure looks plausible.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think at that point, like, you know, I am fundamentally a utilitarian. You know, I think that these things really do come down to, you know, the thing that one is morally obligated to do is do your best calculus of how this pans out. And I think, at least in the hypothetical, as you've described it, as an editor, I would be very open to obscuring the cop's identity in that case, right? Because it doesn't harm the journalistic objectives, which is not to skewer this guy, but to reveal whatever I'm trying to reveal about the broader investigation or the, you know, the underlying politics or policy of the thing. But it's, you know, it's often not even as clear cut as that. You know, we frequently talk about the ways in which the police officers' unions defend cops who are accused of bad behavior of all kinds, you know, from sort of homicidally bad behavior all the way through just, you know, sort of ethical indiscretions. And it's often sort of, it's often very, very hard to adjudicate the claim about whether the cop himself is, you know, the product of a system that incentivizes bad behavior, or whether they are personally, morally culpable over and above just the doing my job claim. So, you know, in that case, I would say, we can and do frequently obscure the identities of tipsters who come to us with stories.
Right.
Lenore Skenazy, for instance, reports all the time on families that are in the middle of some kind of conflict with Child Protective Services. And that's another example where you know, public attention to the case that's searchably tied to an individual could be hugely detrimental to the subject. And yet it's also journalistically important to get the story out. And that's a case where we would, you know, John Doe or Jane Doe it, not only for the family members or for the tipsters, but often also for the police officers or the Child Protective Services agents or even the district where it occurs. It is important as an editor, though, to always know that information yourself.
Right.
It's one thing to not share it with the reader.
Right.
But internally, that information needs to be transparently shared with the editor. And that's how we operate. Not every publication does that. Some people, some publications let their reporters do a little more of a lone wolf act. I think that's cruising for a bruising. We try not to do that here.
Right, right. So here is just to stick with the topic, but shift to something that people don't even think about as a crime facilitating speech issue, but turns out to be an occasionally litigated example of this question. Let's shift away from magazines or even websites, and let's look at very simple scenario on the road. Somebody sees a police officer, let's say, trying to catch speeders. And let's stipulate that catching speeders on a public road is a good idea because, you know, there's danger of injury to non-consenting third parties. And if you're a theoretical liberty.
First, you're stipulating totally innocent cops investigating drug gangs. And now you're stipulating that speeding is bad. I don't know, buddy.
Well, right, right. I take it that I'm not a hardcore libertarian theorist, but I take it a libertarian who has thought a lot about sort of second best questions might say, OK, maybe we shouldn't have public roads.
In fact, I am merely joking. And of course,
I'm sure you are. But I'm sure there are people in the audience who want this proved.
Okay.
So one way of thinking about what makes sense on the public roads from a libertarian perspective is if the roads were privately owned, what would a reasonable owner, kind of with an eye towards market pressures, do? And probably the reasonable owner would set up certain rules of the road, which may very well include speeding restrictions. Because that is a good way of helping some customers, of course, at the expense of others. Now, maybe a reasonable owner would take the German model of the Autobahns, where, as I understand it, there is no speed limit, although I guess even in Germany on some streets there is a speed limit. So let's bracket that. Let's stipulate for now that the police officer is doing something that is at least a reasonable thing to do. So what happens is somebody sees that and then they flash the light at oncoming traffic. And they essentially, that situation flashing their headlights is a signal that means kind of watch out, there's a speed trap. Sometimes it means other things, but in certain contexts, it's pretty clear that I'm warning you something's happening, be careful. And probably what something's happening, the thing that's happening is a police officer there. So one interesting question is, what should the law deal with that? How should the law deal with that? So it is possible that what this is essentially kind of like a lookout at a burglary. Warning people, act innocent because I see somebody coming. That could be basically obstruction of justice. Interestingly, it actually encourages people to do something legal. Thus, what it tells them is stop speeding. Drive under the speed limit right now. So in a sense, you might say, well, it's encouraging them to do something legal. But it's encouraging them, like with all lookouts, encouraging them to do something legal as a means of not getting caught for what they're doing is illegal. So one interesting question, both legal and constitutional, should that be protected speech? By the way, there have been a few trial court cases on the subject, and some of them have said yes.
So I was actually just going to say,
really gets appealed.
I remember Reason covering something very similar to this, probably in, I don't know, 2013, something like that. And my recollection is that the ACLU argued on behalf of the light flasher in, I want to say, Missouri, that that the flashing of the lights was protected speech. And my memory is that we favorably covered that argument. And it's certainly my inclination, but I think my inclination is shaped by what you've just described here, which is that because the signal urges people to do a more lawful thing rather than a less lawful thing, it makes it an easier case. I think that's that's riding on weak intuition rather than a strong logical claim.
I think that's something of a red herring because, again, that's the situation with a lookout for a burglary, that it may even be stop the burglary, don't take the goods. So in a sense, it would prevent the harm from taking place. But the whole purpose of it is to keep the perpetrator from being arrested. And thus, as a result, it facilitates the commission of such acts in the future.
I think the other question is whether light flashers, by and large, would be less inclined to warn dangerous speeders, right? Like, I've definitely flashed my lights to tell people that a speed trap was coming, but I don't think I would do that if the oncoming car was, you know, rushing at 150 miles an hour down a residential street. I'd be like, go right in. See you, buddy. Enjoy that speed trap.
But tell the truth now. You're under oath. When you flash it at somebody coming up, I'm sure you wouldn't if the guy was driving ridiculously fast. But do you really kind of think about, oh, how fast do I think he's driving? Is he driving merely 5 miles above the speed limit or 15? Are we even really that good at figuring out when there's traffic coming, essentially oncoming traffic, where we don't even see kind of it going perpendicular to us, so it's hard for us to measure how far it's moving in any particular length of time. Are we really that good at figuring out how fast they're going?
Right, and so I think the weak intuition is to say, okay, if it was dangerous, I wouldn't do it, and that would make it okay. I think the stronger claim here is that in general, if I as a driver or I as a potential light flasher believe in general that people do drive safely on this strip of road, right? Let's say this is an area I'm familiar with and that there are not, by and large, terrible speeding problems here where school children are constantly being mowed down. You know, my belief that the giving of traffic tickets at speed traps is a revenue rather than safety generating phenomenon would definitely inform my decision there.
Fair enough.
And I think that's similar to many of these other speech questions, right? It's, you know, you're asking the question of whether by helping people evade detection, you are undermining laws that are generally justice promoting, or are you undermining laws that are, you know, foolish or unevenly enforced or for the purposes of revenue extraction or something else.
Right. So let me bring up an example, which I think libertarians should generally agree on the value of the underlying, underlying law. But there are really good reasons both to publish the information and not to. And it's funny, you label this new issue Burn after reading maybe about, what is it now, 30 years now, back in my first career, which was as a computer programmer, I wrote an article which we titled Burn Before Reading, little joke. And it was about computer security for a particular computer system that I was had been writing about at the time that I was programmer working on. One question that I found myself facing there, and I think lots of computer security specialists find themselves facing today is they find a computer security flaw. They have reason to think that there may be bad guys out there using that flaw and using it in highly anti-libertarian ways, basically to break into other people's property with no real justification. They're just criminals who'd be using it. But in order to persuade people to take the time and effort to fix the flaw, you have to persuade people, the good people, the people either who write the software in which the flaw is or who are operating the computers on which the software is running, you have to persuade them that there's a problem and persuade them to take the time and effort to fix that problem. So one possibility is you say, look, you don't believe me that there's a problem. You don't believe me that it's worth a day of your time to try to fix it. Let me just show you right now how easy it is for you to break into your own system. And if once you see that, then surely you'd have to agree that you need to take the time and effort to close that gap, whether for your own system or for all the systems running your software. That's one possibility. But then the problem is the bad guys can see it too, and it can exploit it on all the systems that haven't had this problem patched. On the other hand, you could say, I'm not going to tell you what the flaw is. I'm just going to assure you that there is such a flaw. But then people being understandably skeptical will say, really? Is there really a flaw? Is it really easy to exploit? I don't really fully believe that. So that seems to me is an interesting question. I think it's one that Reason probably would rarely run into, although perhaps Wired or other magazines that specialize in computer stuff might, and certainly bloggers who write about security issues do. As I understand it, they've developed some norms, like you notify the company first if there is a particular company involved and give them some week's head start to try to fix it or something like that. But it seems to me it's an interesting and genuinely difficult question that people have to face sometimes.
Yeah, I think it also probably, again, has to do with your reasonable expectation about how much harm could be done before the loophole was closed, right? Or whatever the equivalent is. If it's catastrophic failure of 97% of the world's computer systems,
right.
Maybe don't publish
right.
it. But if it's the evaluating the line south of that starts to get trickier. For us, we are often in a position of describing to people how laws could be circumvented with two motivations, right? Like one is the motivation to improve the way that laws are written, right? When we talk about, for instance, drug paraphernalia, this is something that Jacob Sullum has written about for many, many years, that in the case of many types of drug paraphernalia in many states, your intent for the object matters, right? So though he, in this issue, describes, okay, if you carve a channel and then another channel at a right angle into an apple, it's just an apple with a hole in the middle. If you put a little piece of perforated tinfoil at the top with the idea of using said apple as a pipe to smoke an illegal substance, then it becomes contraband. And there's not really a way to describe why such a law would be problematic without also describing how to violate the law and perhaps how to avoid violating it based on the technicalities
right.
of the interpretation.
Right.
So I think it's analogous. And again, I think my answer to, well, is this sort of morally permissible to do is heavily informed by my belief that laws against paraphernalia for smoking anything anywhere are dumb laws and that they cause
right.
massive social harm. So it makes the question easier to answer. And that's, it's more a question of where do we go looking for stories than how we evaluate a story sort of once it already exists in the world. But we purposely go looking for stories in places where we are already confident that undermining the law would be a moral good.
Right. Fair enough. And of course, as a law professor, I'm always looking for the hard questions, because those are the interesting ones. So let me tell you something that I found when I was researching my crime facilitating speech article. There was paper, I think it was in some conference proceedings, which, by the way, this article came out in 2005. 15 years before, it would have been in conference proceedings, read just by experts, and then invisible to anybody else. But by 2005, and even I think it had been published maybe 5-10 years before, all of that was online. And the paper was about how easy it is to defeat fingerprint-based locks. And the purpose of the paper pretty clearly was, the author was saying, I'm trying to persuade you not to fall for the hoax of fingerprint-based locks. People are going to be trying to pitch them to you as secure. They're not secure. And here's how I'll prove to you they're not secure. At the same time, it seems pretty clear that the author of the paper didn't think that defeating fingerprint-based locks as a general matter is a good thing. I mean, the locks are usually used in order to protect people's private property and maybe even protect people's persons. Maybe you can have it on your home or on some other property where people are and you want to prevent somebody from breaking in and attacking them.
This was not a person with radical beliefs who believed that the locking of things was morally bad, presumably.
Exactly. You can imagine them, but I don't think he was that.
I think I've met that guy at a bar here in D.C. once or twice, but, that's
I'm sure in a nation of 300 million people, I am sure there's one of anybody. And I take it the magazine attracts people, rightly so, I might add, with unusual, idiosyncratic, iconoclastic views. We love them. We love them.
Yes.
For that. But in any event, so one interesting question is, how should one deal with a situation like that, where really, you know, you like the idea of security. In fact, you're trying to promote security. And here's the one extra twist. You're right. If this is something that you know will allow somebody to break in and launch the nuclear missiles, you might balk at that. But part of the problem with a lot of these security specialists who are thinking about blowing the whistle on security gaps is that they see the upside and the downside of publicizing this as being really quite comparable, that if something is being used to secure something really important, of course there's a downside in publicizing it in a way that informs people how to break in. But there's also a downside in keeping quiet about that, because then the fix won't be made. People won't take the time and effort to make the fix. And then this potentially very dangerous breaking in will be more likely to happen.
I listened to a podcast years ago. It was a 99% Invisible, which is Roman Mars's podcast. It's excellent. I recommend it to our listeners. And it was an episode called Perfect Security, which describes a period of about 70 years ending in the 1850s, where there was essentially an unbreakable lock, where a locksmith built a lock, and it was widely used. And also this same locksmith, or perhaps a competitor, I forget, had a lock and a set of lock picks sort of installed on the front of their shop and said, please try hard to break this lock. They essentially put out a notice for hackers to come by and test their security in the spirit of knowing whether the lock was in fact breakable as soon as possible. And the sort of interesting resolution of it is that eventually someone did break the lock, but it took 52 hours of focused work. And so even though the lock was no longer inviolable, it was still widely in use because the weakness was still small enough to make it the best technology on the market and therefore advantageous to lock up your goods. And the podcast sort of raises this question of, well, think about it, what it would have meant to exist in a time when you could have a private document and you could put it in a box and you could lock that box and only the possessor of the key could get into it, right? That's actually not really that's not really the world we exist in anymore. Like, privacy is much, much, much harder to come by in some ways. And I think it's an interesting question to think about, in particular, the fact that the possessor of this lock, the builder of this lock, would have found it the best approach to ask people to break it, you know, to sort of say, let's see about how to violate this protection collectively and in public, rather than, you know, trying to discourage or sort of buy off people who could do so.
Oh, right. And my understanding is that a lot of security specialists are very firm believers in that
right.
The only way to
right.
know
I mean,
that
this is common right. practice now. Yeah.
Right. The complicated thing is that sometimes, again, once it emerges that there is a problem, let's hypothesize in the story that you were telling me, by the way, fascinating. I hadn't heard of it before. I need to listen to that podcast. But let's hypothesize that somehow somebody came up with a means through which somebody could in 5 minutes anywhere in the world break that. And should the person maybe say, look, I'm going to reveal this to the maker and say, I'm giving you a year. Year to inform your customers, to sell better locks, to whatever else. Because if I were to announce it today when people don't have the opportunity, then all will happen is that all of these very valuable things that people have been securing with this lock, on the assumption that the lock is really effective, will now be vulnerable immediately without much of a chance to fix it. So it's a hard question. And it's a weird hypothetical back then, because we're talking there about the world of hardware. With the world of software, that actually becomes a little bit more plausible in some situations.
Yeah. Well, and the other point that this podcast made was that you know, in the end, the pickability of a lock, I mean, this lock, the Brahma lock, is not, it's not the lock that's on your front door, right? Like, we actually use pretty easily beatable locks all the time. And in this issue, for instance, we have a tutorial about how to or an essay about how to pick handcuffs, right? I mean, we routinely use a technology that has known vulnerabilities as a central part of our personal security, both in terms of our front doors, right, and in terms of handcuffs. And that's because we actually rely on social protections to discourage people from picking or breaking those locks, right, as much as we rely on the locks themselves, which I think is another question that's raised about much of this sort of area that we're discussing here. Like, in talking about how easy it is to break these locks or, you know, break these laws, are we changing the underlying social culture that psychologically prevents people from doing so?
Right.
And you know, this is something that comes up, that came up in our editorial discussions. You know, are any of these behaviors that we're theoretically enabling in this issue something we want to discourage people from doing, even though we want to highlight that they could do it and they should know that it's a possibility?
Right. So let me return to an item that we talked about a little earlier, and you mentioned with regard to accused prostitutes and johns. But let's broaden that a little bit, because I think this is actually a difficult question that a lot of publishers, both like Reason, but also individual tweeters, individual bloggers, sometimes run into. Let's say that somebody does something that you think is worth publicly condemning. It's not a crime, but it's something bad. Then the question is, how much information about the person do you post in your publication about this? So knowing that some fraction, perhaps a small fraction, but still a significant number of readers, either immediate readers or readers to whom this is forwarded, will use that information to anything from send threats to this person to maybe actually physically attack the person to maybe call them in the middle of the night and annoy them or something along those lines. So sometimes this actually comes up if you publish the name of a person. There was a case in which there was somebody who was running a Twitter feed called Cards Against Harassment. I don't know why exactly it was called that, but it was originally an attempt to shame street harassers or accused street harassers. Ended up being used by this poster to find people who are saying kind of rude things about supposedly underdressed women or women who are wearing revealing clothing online. Find pictures of those commenters where they show themselves without a shirt, generally men, and then post them in order to shame them for their supposed online slut-shaming of these other of these women. So in any case, this poster was running this account and was running it pseudonymously. And then there ended up being a case in which she got a court order ordering somebody who had been outing her to stop revealing her name. And she was actually a city attorney and actually a part-time federal prosecutor as well. So I wrote an article about it on the Vala Conspiracy at Reason, where I mentioned her name and I mentioned the Twitter feed. And I thought it was legitimate in part because she had gone to court to get this gag order on the critic. It became a public record. It became a court case. It was an important court case that I thought was important to talk about. And she herself had some considerable position in government, not very high level, but still. And then relatedly also, she did seem to be reluctant to be outed, but she was somebody who was perfectly willing to out people on her own Twitter feed. So for all of these reasons, I didn't feel much compunction. But now I wonder if I should have felt more compunction about revealing the name. I haven't heard any indication that anybody used that in order to send her rude messages, much less threats or some such. But there is always this risk. And then the question is, what about including a person's address or including a person's email address or a person's phone number? Sometimes one does that deliberately. Sometimes it just happens to arise in documents that you are about to post. And then the question is, do you redact them? So How do you tend to navigate this kind of thing when you're writing about somebody and you think this may lead to possibly criminal, at the very least highly annoying messages to them, but at the same time you think the address and maybe where they work and various other things are actually newsworthy?
So,
and certainly the name.
There's one specific category of this that I think is controversial, or at least it's controversial in my bubble, such as it is right now, which is quote tweeting. Right. So this is the occasion on which someone using a public platform like Twitter says something. And then someone with many, many more followers or more clout or influence or status makes their tweet available to a larger audience, often with some kind of negative commentary, right? And this is, to some people, an absolutely condemnable, beyond the pale move. And I really struggle with the thinking behind that. I mean, I think if you have a reasonable expectation that behavior would actually lead to viable death threats, then okay. But for the most part, we're not talking about that, right? For the most part, we're just talking about annoying rhetoric. We're talking about other people tweeting at a person who has themselves already signed up for this platform. I feel very strongly that there's a distinction between taking information that the person themselves has already made public, including if their Twitter account is their full name, and repeating that information versus sort of ferreting out additional contact information or location information for the sake of eliciting, you know, follow-up contacts, right? So I think it's a hard call. I think it's a genuinely hard call, and that there are many cases where you are going to kind of have to go on your best guess of what will happen with the thing once you set it out into the world, and your best guess might be wrong.
Right, that's right. And I'll say my sense is that these kinds of retweets or other kinds of things where the name of somebody, it could be an article that condemns some government employee who's doing something, but you put out the name, you put out either include the email address, or it's very easy to find the email address of the person. Generally speaking, there isn't going to be any physical attack. But it probably is not unlikely they will get something that might look like a threat of violence. Not likely to actually turn into violence, but at least likely to produce something that's likely to look like a threat of violence, in part because if you've got 100,000 readers, which not all of us do, but Reason does and other places do. If you've got 100,000 readers, if 0.01% of them use this as are so incensed and so wrong, so immoral, as to actually go and send a death threat, that's 10 people. That's 10 death threats, which presumably will make the subject kind of upset. And maybe they're not quite death threats, but at least threats of violence or some such. So if one counts the risk of threats of violence, then that will be pretty common pretty much among anybody who has a large and occasionally rowdy user base, or not user base, reader set. And they will actually often know that this is so because it's happened before. So,
well, I think the other thing to note here is, and this is very dodgy territory to get into, but there are threats of violence and then there are threats of violence.
Right.
Right? And this is something where, you know, I know there is quite a lot of legal precedent around trying to establish which ones we take seriously and why. But as you know, and as many of our listeners know, Reason a few years back was subpoenaed and then gagged around stuff that our commenters had posted in a post about the decision in the Silk Road case, where Russ Albrecht was jailed for two consecutive life sentences for running this anonymous online bazaar. And our commenters said some things about the judge. And what the things that they said were a reference to the movie Fargo, which included a character who's put in a wood chipper. And then also some things that just said, like, there's a place in hell for this judge kind of stuff. And the justification for subpoenaing the information about those commenters was that it was a threat of violence,
right,
against a judge.
Right.
And it's hard for me to imagine a world in which, in good faith, you could perceive those particular posts as genuine threats. On the other hand, this judge had been exposed to more genuine threats, from my understanding, from anonymous sources or quasi-anonymous sources, because feelings ran very high around this case. And the people who were following it were, by and large, more facile online than the typical human being.
Right.
So, you know, I think that's it's a tough place to be in to say, well, was that threat of violence really likely to be carried out? But that is something that we ask courts to do all the time.
Right. But the flip side, or the thing that when we ask courts to do that, we actually have trials. We have all sorts of information gathering and such. As a writer or as an editor, one has to make a decision kind of anticipating things for the future. And the problem is that given that there is this risk, especially when one has a large enough reader base and possibly a rowdy enough reader base, given that there's this risk, anytime you mention the name of anybody, could be a government official, could be a legislator, could be a judge, could be a university administrator, could be some activist, there's always some risk. I think unless one hides one's head in the sand, one has to acknowledge that there's going to be some possibility that this person gets something that at least looks like it might be a plausible threat.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question is, what do you do? And I think the answer has got to be that you can't let that stop you from criticizing people. And of course, you need to make sure it's fair-minded and proportional criticisms, but still, you can't let that stop you from criticizing people just because some tiny fraction of the audience is going to misbehave based on that.
This is something that we write about a lot with campus culture, right? The idea that hurtful speech is should be a major focus of concern and enforcement on campuses in particular, speech that makes people feel bad or upset. And I think far too often in those discussions, the counterbalancing free speech and or social good rationales get discounted.
Right. I mean, I think that's absolutely right.
On campuses, it is often largely hinges just on the question of free speech, but in the press, I think it is much more often the case that, you know, the publication is trying to make an argument or a point or disseminate important information that, you know, that is that should be counterbalanced against the bad feelings or even fear or even legitimate fear of some kind of repercussions for the person you name. But it's hard as an editor.
Right.
It's hard.
Right.
I imagine as a judge, it's quite hard to properly contextualize and see where those lines are.
I think that's absolutely right. Although I should say that I think there's an important difference, and I think you and I probably agree on this, between material that's merely offensive and material that is at least plausibly threatening. Even material that on reflection one would realize probably this person isn't going to be serious about it. There's a reason why we do have a true threats exception to the First Amendment for true threats of illegal conduct and especially of violent conduct. And
I think you and I agree, but I think there's at least a plausible case to be made that the social norms on that question are evolving quite rapidly right now.
Maybe
and
that's
that,
right.
While the legal line might be relatively clear, the conflation and in some cases I think the purposeful conflation of true threat and mean thing to say those lines are shifting pretty fast.
Right. So I agree, and I share your I think implied criticism, and I'm happy to make it explicit, the criticism of the attempt to mush together those lines. But I do just want to stress that it's also one reason we have this in the Crime Facilitating Speech podcast, this is a question. The true threat example is a situation where it's perfectly clear that we ourselves shouldn't threaten people, at least unless it's obvious hyperbole or a joke or something like that. So and if I actually threatened someone with violence and it was a true threat, I could be prosecuted and rightly so. The question is to what extent should I refrain from other speech that might lead some fraction of my audience to engaging in this illegal speech. illegal speech being threats of violence. And I think the answer is generally not, although an interesting question is, what if this wasn't just a name but a home address? I should say, by the way, I've litigated some of those cases arguing there's a First Amendment right to publish home addresses. Actually, I've litigated one such case. We won, and there were past cases that also recognized this right, and there are plausible arguments. But my guess is most of us would probably say that we shouldn't publish the home addresses unless there's really extremely powerful reason to do that. And then here's one way of testing that. Occasionally, you have controversies where there's a local politician who's either being accused of not living in his district or being accused of sometimes he's maintaining some kind of bad material at his house, like junky cars or whatever else, at the same time that he's talking about how to beautify the city. Or he has bars on his windows at the same time he's faulting businesses that do that. So the question is, do you publish the address and maybe a photo of the house saying, see here, you could drive by yourself, this person's home, and see what a hypocrite he is? Or do you say, you know, and makes it a little too likely there'll be something more than just threats, maybe the actual vandalism or violence against him?
Of course, there's also a understanding here about whether public people deserve or should be accorded different
standards.
That's
a great question. You're absolutely right.
Private people, right? And of course, my inclination is always, sure, go after politicians for anything. But that's again, well, more
what
of
if
an
it's
instinctive
a private,
reaction.
What if it's let's say a private person, but one who's spoken out about certain things, sort of talking about
right.
Energy use, and it turns out that his house has all of these features that are obviously energy inefficient, and somebody
right.
says,
and this is what I was going to say, is that the temptation to go after people for hypocrisy,
right.
I think, is a strong one, and it can often lead you to more dubious places. And I'm thinking here in part of, you know, there are many, many, many people in this world who believe that basically any Republican politician, or maybe any politician who's ever said the words family values while on the campaign trail, which includes plenty of Democrats, every single one of those people, any sordid detail of their personal life, any time past or present, is basically fair game. And I think it's a position that one could defend, but it in practice often leads to, I think, a sense of moral righteousness about, exposing details that maybe are not super relevant to that person's conduct as a politician. I don't know. I mean, I think there are difficult calls. I will say I am surprised that it doesn't come up more in some ways in my job. And this may be because we are, to some extent, a policy
right.
focused publication in many ways. And so we are often looking to a larger principle or kind of a trend rather than an individual case. But we do a fair amount of investigative work, and even some of the policy stories that we tell have an individual at their heart or a sort of a personal story as their hook. And we often, I guess, do have to make a decision about whether we attribute the failings to the law or to an agent of the law personally.
Right.
And I think to sort of bring us back to the very beginning of this conversation here at the end of it, that distinction isn't always so clear. Sometimes the law and whose hands it rests in are not clearly distinct things.
Absolutely right. This opens the door also to a huge number of other things that I'd love to talk about with you in some other podcast. Things like, on the one hand, the right to be forgotten, which is a legal concept, strikes me as a very bad idea. But again, as an ethical question is always a difficult one. When does one respond to a request to remove a name from archives of a newspaper or a magazine or a blog that are 15 years old? Another question that I've been investigating recently is I'm now seeing libel lawsuits that are basically being litigated under seal because the plaintiff is saying, look, I've been libeled, but if I have to, in open court, explain what the libel was or even explain who I am, then that will only magnify the libel because people will start writing stories about this. So as a result, I would like to have this whole case be litigated under seal. And on one hand, my reaction is, and in fact, I'm actually now in some courts actively trying to get some of those cases unsealed, just as my capacity as a writer and a citizen, I'm entitled to intervene in these kinds of cases to assert a public interest in openness. There's a very strong open courts tradition in America. So my reaction is, look, you can't have a libel case without the information on what the alleged libel is being public. It's kind of like Hamlet without the prince, or maybe Othello without an explanation of what exactly Iago was saying. But on the other hand, look, I totally understand the position of the plaintiff who's saying, look, by suing, I risk, because of the Streisand effect, I risk just further amplifying the original libel. I've got solid evidence that this is not a closed case. I'm being libeled. In fact, maybe I'm being extorted through the threat of continuing libel. And I feel I can prove it to the judge. I just want the judge to listen and then seal the case if the judge is persuaded. And so I'm against that. I think that's impermissible. But I think it's a really interesting and difficult question these days of how you deal with material that is genuinely libelous or sometimes, again, not maybe as a matter of law, but as a matter of media ethics, deal with material that's really quite accurate, but maybe the person, for example, has been acquitted of a crime. Maybe the charges have been dropped, and what they want is they want the story about the arrest to disappear, or at least their names to disappear from it. Difficult questions that I think many an editor has to face. I'd love to talk to you about them some other time.
Sounds like a great preview for some upcoming podcasts, but I think we'll leave it there for now. Thank you very much, Eugene, for speaking with Reason.
Thank you. It has been such a pleasure. And I like to think that I'm not speaking with Reason. I am speaking among colleagues.
We're chatting
amongst
ourselves.
Reason.com.
This has been Catherine Mangue Ward, editor-in-chief of Reason, and Eugene Volokh, founder and impresario at the Volokh Conspiracy and law professor at UCLA, talking about crime facilitating speech and all kinds of other quandaries. If you like what you heard, you should head over to iTunes, where you can subscribe to our podcast, and you should rate and review us while you're there.